/reg/join. Maybe this will be easy. Maybe it won't be. It's possible you'll run into an absolute blank wall at a particular organization. Everyone who works there is pledged to secrecy, and they have shipped all their ex-employees to Siberia. In that case, seek out information on their nearest competitor in the same geographic area. For example, let us say you were trying to find out managerial salaries at Bank X, and that place was proving to be inscrutable about what they pay their managers. You would then turn to Bank Y as your research base to see if the information is easier to come by there. And if it is, you can assume the two may be basically similar in their pay scales, and that what you learned about Bank Y is probably applicable to Bank X. Note, in your salary research, take note of the fact that most governmental agencies have civil service positions paralleling those in private industry, and government job descriptions and pay ranges are available to the public. Go to the nearest city, county, regional, state, or federal civil service office, find the job description nearest the kind of job you are seeking in private industry, and then ask the starting salary. When this is all done, if you want to be a true expert at this game, then you're going to have to do a little bit of math here. Suppose you guess that the employer's range for the kind of job you're seeking is $36,500 to $47,200. Before you go in for the interview anywhere, you figure out an asking range for yourself that you're going to use when and if the interview gets to the salary negotiation part. This asking range is clever in that it should hook in just below the employer's maximum and then go up from there. This is how it works. If the employer's range is $36,500 to $47,200, then your range gets stated as $47,000 to $58,000. And so, when the employer has stated a figure, probably around their lowest, that is $36,500, you will be ready to respond with something along these lines. I understand, of course, the constraints under which all organizations are operating these days, but I am confident that my productivity is going to be such that it will justify a salary, and here you mention the range above, where your bottom figure starts just below the top of their range and goes up from there, in the range of $47,000 to $58,000. It will help a lot during this discussion if you are prepared to show in what ways you will make money or in what ways you will save money for that organization, such as would justify precisely this higher salary you are asking for. Even if they accept your offer at the bottom of your range, you are still near the top figure they're willing to pay. Yes, it's clever. Yes, it's risky. Yes, it takes some work. But you've got the brains to pull it off. You've got the brains to be good at this salary negotiation game. What if, after all the trouble you went to, this just doesn't work? At least at that place. The employer has a ceiling they have to work with. It's below what you're asking, and you are unwilling to lower your definition of what you're worth. Daniel Porro, job expert from Switzerland, suggests that if you're dying to work there, but they cannot afford the salary you need and deserve, you might consider offering them part of your time. If you need and believe you deserve, say, $50,000 annually, but they can only afford $30,000, you might consider offering them 3 days a week of your time for that $30,000. 30 divided by 50 equals 3/5 of a 5-day work week. This leaves you free to take work elsewhere during those other 2 days. You will, of course, determine to produce so much work during those 3 days per week you are there that they will be ecstatic about this bargain. Won't you? The sixth secret of salary negotiation. Know how to bring the salary negotiation to a close. Don't leave it just hanging. Salary negotiation with this employer is not finished until you've addressed more than salary. Unless you're an independent contractor, you want to talk about so-called fringe benefits. Fringes, such as life insurance, health benefits or health plans, vacation or holiday time, and retirement programs, typically add anywhere from 15 to 28% to many worker salaries. That is to say, if an employee receives $3,000 salary per week, the fringe benefits are worth another $450 to $840 per week. So before you walk into an interview, you should decide what benefits are particularly important to you. And then, after the basic salary discussion is settled, you can go on to ask them what benefits they offer there. If you've given this any thought beforehand, you should have already decided what benefits are most important to you and be ready to fight for those. And when all this is done, the discussion of the job, the finding out if they like you and if you like them, the salary negotiation, and the concluding discussion of benefits, then you want to get everything they're offering summarized in writing. Believe me, you do. In writing, or typed, and signed. Many executives, unfortunately, forget what they told you during the hiring interview, or even deny they ever said such a thing. It shouldn't happen, but it does. Sometimes they honestly forget what they said. Other times, of course, they're playing a game. Or their successor is, who may disown any unwritten promises you claim they made to you at the time of hiring. They may respond with, "I don't know what caused them to say that to you, but they clearly exceeded their authority, and of course we can't be held to that." I repeat, get it all in writing and signed. It's called a letter of agreement or employment contract. If it is a small employer, 10 or fewer employees, they may not know how to draw one up. Just put the search term sample letter of agreement between employer and employee into your favorite search engine, and you'll get lots of free examples. I particularly like the one from inc.com. You or the employer can write this up, then they can sign it. You have every right to ask for this. If they simply won't give it to you, beware. Remember, job hunting always involves luck to some degree. But with a little bit of luck and a lot of hard work and determination on your part, the instructions in this book should work for you. Do not pray for tasks equal to your powers. Pray for powers equal to your tasks. Philip Brooks, 1835 to 1893. Chapter 10. How to deal with any handicaps you have. I know what you're thinking. If you got a job interview, or interviews, and got turned down, you're thinking that there is some handicap, hidden or obvious, that is keeping you from getting hired. Maybe you were thinking this even before you went in for an interview. You turned to this chapter straight away, didn't you? You're thinking, "I'm getting turned down, or I will be turned down, because I have a physical handicap, or I have a mental handicap, or I never graduated from high school, or I never graduated from college, or I am just graduating, or I just graduated 2 years ago and am still unemployed, or I graduated way too long ago, or I'm too beautiful or handsome, or I'm too ugly, or I'm too fat, or I'm too thin, or I'm too old, or I'm too young, or I'm too near retirement, or I've only had one employer in life, or I have hopped from job to job all my life. Or, I've been out of the job market too long. Or, I've been in the job market far too long. Or, I'm too inexperienced. Or, I have a prison record. Or, I have a psychiatric history. Or, I have not had enough education and am underqualified. Or, I have too much education and am overqualified. Or, I am Hispanic. Or, I am black. Or, I am Asian. Or, my English is not very good. Or, I speak heavily accented English. Or, I'm too much of a specialist. Or, I'm too much of a generalist. Or, I'm ex-clergy. Or, I'm ex-military. Or, I'm too assertive. Or, I'm too shy. Or, I've only worked for volunteer organizations. Or, I've only worked for small organizations. Or, I've only worked for large organizations. Or, I've only worked for the government. Or, I come from a very different culture or background. Or, I come from another industry. Or, I come from another planet. If all of this were true, there would be only 3 weeks in our life when we are employable. Okay, but let's get one thing straight from the beginning here. You can't possibly have a handicap that will keep employers from hiring you. You can only have a handicap that will keep some employers from hiring you. No matter what handicap you have, or think you have, it cannot possibly keep you from getting hired anywhere in the world. It can only keep you from getting hired at some places. As I said in Chapter 5, there are millions of separate, distinct, unrelated employers out there with very different requirements for hiring. Unless you look dirty, wild, and disreputable, and smell really bad, if you know what your talent is, I guarantee some employer is looking for you. Even if you're crazy, there's some employer crazier than you. You have to keep going. Some employers out there do want you no matter what the others think. Your job is to find them. You cannot generalize about employers. I mentioned this, of course, in Chapter 1, and here we are back to that same truth. As far as your handicap is concerned, you can generalize this much. All employers divide for you into just two tribes. Employers who are interested in hiring you for what you can do versus employers who are bothered by what you cannot do. No matter how many times you run into the latter kind, once you discover their attitude, you should just courteously thank them for their time and ask if they know of any other employers who might be interested in someone with your skills. Then, gently take your leave. And speaking of courtesy, always remember to write and mail them a thank you note that very night, no matter how mad or frustrated they may have made you feel. And then keep going. Day after day, week after week, month after month if necessary, until you find the other kind of employer, the one who only looks at what you can do, not at what you can't. Everyone is handicapped. You may wonder how many job hunters are handicapped. Well, the answer is everyone. Or you may wonder how many people in the entire workforce are handicapped. Again, the answer is everyone. What? Well, sure. A real handicap means disability. There are some things a person does not have the ability to do. The reason doesn't matter. Now, consider how many skills there are in the whole world. Nobody knows the number, so let's make one up. Let's say there are 4,341 transferable skills in the world. How many of those 4,341 do you think the average person has? Nobody knows that number either, so let's again make one up. Let's guess big here. Let's guess the average person has 1,341 skills. That's 1,341 things the average worker can do. You know, things like dig, analyze, communicate, sell, design, cook, repair, those sorts of things. But if there are 4,341 skills in all the world, and the average person only has 1,341 of them, then that leaves 3,000 things the average person can't do. Of course, what those 3,000 are will vary from person to person, but in the end, everybody is handicapped. Everybody. So when you go job hunting, if you have a real handicap, but it doesn't keep you from performing the particular job or career that you are going after, then what's so special about your handicap compared with other people's? The answer is nothing. Unless you are so focused on the idea that you are handicapped and so obsessed with what you can't do that you have forgotten all the things you can do. Unless you're thinking of all the reasons why an employer might not hire you instead of all the reasons why an employer would be lucky to get you. Unless you're going about your job hunt feeling like a job beggar, rather than standing tall to offer yourself as a helpful resource for this employer. What you can do, what you can't. To get your mind off what you can't do and onto what you can, take a piece of paper, online or off, and divide it into two columns. I have this skill. I don't have this skill. Then get a list of transferable skills from somewhere. A. You could use the skills grid in Chapter 5. B. Or you could use the famous list of 246 skills as verbs that you will find in the PDF files included in this audiobook. C. Or if you want a way longer list for any reason, Canadian career expert Martin Buckland has a free mega list of 2013 resume action verbs at his site Elite Resumes, http://anelitresume.com. Whichever list you use, copy as many of the skills as you choose onto that piece of paper, but put each skill in the proper column, depending on whether you can do the skill or cannot. Or not yet, anyway. Use additional sheets if needed. When you are done with these two columns, can and can't, pick out your favorite five things that you can do and love to do, and write out some examples of how you actually did that, sometime in your past, your recent past if possible. Here are some of the 246 skills as verbs. Achieving. Acting, adapting, addressing, administering, discovering, dispensing, displaying, disproving, dissecting, innovating, inspecting, inspiring, installing, instituting, predicting, preparing, prescribing, presenting, printing, sewing, shaping, sharing, showing, and singing. Dream killers. What about a disability that seems to negate all your dreams? There's something you've always dreamed of doing, but your handicap makes it impossible. Well, first of all, someone may have invented a technology or a simple strategy that gets around that disability. You never know. There are some very clever people in the world. How to find them? If your particular disability has a name, look it up on the internet and see what turns up. Look particularly on the list it gives you for any professional association that deals with your disability. contact them and ask them what information they have. For example, let us say that you are wrestling with decreased vision. Some 3 million U.S. adults over the age of 40 are, but search for low vision or visually impaired, and you will turn up techniques for dealing with this handicap. For example, https://lowvisionfocus.org from the Hadley School for the Blind has free audios and videos dealing with such themes as how to use the iPhone and iPad to implement your vision. An alternative way of dealing with a dream killer is to search for jobs similar to the one you hunger to do but can't. Example, one career counselor was working with a young adult who was dying to be a commercial airline pilot. The killer, his eyesight was too poor to be a pilot. Well, there was a clue as to where to go from there. It was the way our would-be pilot talked about planes. He loved planes. So the counselor sent him out to the large airport nearby with a pad of yellow paper and a pen, and told him to list every kind of occupation that he saw or heard about there at the airport, besides pilot. The next day he showed his list to his counselor. It was very long. When asked if he'd come across any occupation that interested him, he said, "Yes, I love the idea of making the seats that they put inside new airplanes." So that's the job he pursued. He ended up in the airline industry, even though he couldn't be a pilot. Disability or prejudice? That's the $64,000 question. It is crucial to keep in mind that handicap is a broad term, which can refer to two entirely different things. On the one hand, job hunters' disabilities. On the other hand, employers' prejudices. There is a huge difference, and you need to remember that. Suppose you are completely deaf. You cannot hear, even with technological augmentation. If you are considering a job that requires acute hearing, then that is a disability. It means there are certain skills you don't have that are essential for doing that job. But now let us suppose you can hear perfectly, but you are way overweight. If you are applying for that same job, overweight is not a disability unless it interferes with your ability to do that work. Nonetheless, a particular employer may be prejudiced against overweight people and simply won't hire you, even though this has nothing to do with your ability to do the job. So, there you have the difference. A disability is something within you. A prejudice is something within the employer. Both may technically be handicaps, because both may keep you from getting hired. But it is important to understand that a real handicap is a disability you have. It may be that you simply cannot do some important task required in that particular job. On the other hand, a prejudice is a phantom handicap. It may raise its ugly head in one particular interview or more, but if you keep on going, find the right employer, then poof, the so-called handicap vanishes. You must just be sure you don't share those prejudices. That is, don't look at yourself through their eyes. Look at yourself through your own eyes. The key employer prejudices. 1. Out of work too long. The employer prejudice that is getting all the attention currently relates to how long you've been out of work. We saw this in Chapter 1. It is a prejudice that some employers have and some employers don't. If you've been out of work a year or more, you will find employers who won't hire you because of it. Too bad. Just keep going until you find employers who don't have that prejudice. For a list of some of them who have promised to hire even the long-term unemployed, see http://big.assets.huffingtonpost.com/EST_practices_recruiting_ long-term_unemployed.pdf. 2. Racial, religious, or sexual identity stereotypes. Some employers are prejudiced on site against blacks or Muslims or Mexicans or Asians or Native Americans or gays or transgender or, well, you name it. Some employers won't hire such people. You'd think that in this day and age, such prejudices would have been stamped out long ago. Sad to say, no. It's only some employers. But unfortunately, the prejudiced are often very crafty. Anti-discrimination laws won't stop them. They have figured their way around everything. They often justify their prejudice with stereotypes that are demonstrably false. 3. Age. The next employer prejudice that you may run into is age. Reason? Millions of baby boomers, the 76 million people born 1946 to 1964, are beginning to enter the so-called retirement years. A lot of us are not going to find generous pensions waiting when we hit 60 or 65, but are going to have to keep working long after we ever thought we would have to. And how easy will it be to get hired at that age? Guess. But again, your comfort must lie in the fact that this is a prejudice, not a handicap. Some employers won't be prejudiced that you are as old as you are if they see you are still on fire with passion about what you do, not merely marking time between now and then. The related employer prejudice that is rearing its ugly head these days concerns money. Given all your years of experience, many who are job hunting over 50 expect a salary befitting all their years of experience and wisdom, only to discover that some employers are prejudiced against paying that much, since they could hire two less experienced workers in their 20s for what it would cost them to hire just us. And yet, despite this prejudice, there are still employers out there who will hire you regardless of how old you are, if. And here we have a lot of ifs, all of which lie within your control, thank heaven. They will hire you if you choose to approach a small company and they don't have to put you late into a pension plan. And they will hire you if you come with a positive attitude toward your aging. For example, thinking of your current age, not in terms of work, but in terms of music, particularly a symphony. A symphony traditionally has four movements, as they're called. So does life. There is the first movement, infancy, then the second movement, the time of learning, the long third movement follows, the time of working, and finally, a fourth movement. It is traditionally spoken of in terms of work, hence we call it retirement. It is much better to think of it as the fourth movement. A triumphant, powerful ending to the symphony of our life here on Earth. Go listen to Beethoven's Third Symphony, the Eroica. And they will hire you if you convey energy, even in this period of your life. Ask any employer what they are looking for when they interview a job candidate who is 50 years or older, and they will tell you, energy. Okay, but where shall we find energy after 50? When we were younger, energy came from the physical side of our nature. We were feeling our oats, as they say. We could go all day and all night. My, where do you get all your energy? Our grandmother would ask us. We were a dynamo of physical energy. But after 50, physical energy may be harder to come by, despite workouts, exercise, and marathons. Increasingly, our energy must spring not from our muscles, but from our excitement about life. There are inevitably some employers dying to have that excitement in their organization. And they will hire you if you have done some life work planning. And you know alternative ways to describe who you are and what you can do, because you did the homework on who you are in Chapter 5. And They will hire you if you keep going on interviews until you encounter an employer or two who isn't prejudiced about your age. What do I mean by keep going? Well, here is one successful job hunter's actual records. The process she is referring to is Daniel Porro's pie method, described at the end of this chapter. Here are the figures you wanted. In the course of my surveying, September through November, I was referred to 120-plus people. Of these, I contacted 84 and actually met with 50. I met most people at their offices, a few for lunch, a couple for dinner, and one for breakfast. The process worked so well for me, I am really excited about my new prospects. Job hunting success, regardless of your age, often requires this kind of persistence. Keeping at it, keeping at it, keeping at it. Working at your job hunt far longer and far harder than the average job hunter would ever dream of doing, because you know you will be valuable to any organization that is able to see you clearly without prejudice. 4. Returning veterans. Next employer prejudice, hiring returning vets. According to a recent survey, 41% of returning vets do not feel their military skills and training are respected by employers. Well, let's face it, some, but only some, employers are prejudiced against hiring returning vets. They've seen one too many headlines about PTSD, even though 4 out of 5 returning vets do not have post-traumatic stress disorder. Fortunately, there are other employers who know this and are actually prejudiced in favor of hiring returning vets. 5. Ex-offenders. Next employer prejudice, hiring ex-offenders. When you run into any employer prejudice, what you should do is Google it by name on the internet and see what you turn up. You may discover some very useful advice, strategies, or resources. This is the case if you are, or you work with, an ex-offender. There are a number of little books to help. For example, Mark Drevno has written a book for ex-offenders called Jails to Jobs, 7 Steps to Becoming Employed, 2014. Mark will send readers of Parachute an electronic version of his book for free if they will just email him at info@jailstojobs.org requesting same, and mentioning that they are a reader of Parachute. He also runs a public charity called Jails to Jobs, which has a website called, you guessed it, www.jailstojobs.org, which gives step-by-step help with finding employment. There, Mark has a tattoo removal directory, which is helpful for anyone who feels their tattoos are keeping them from getting a job and want them removed. Mark also has a new book, Tattoo Removal, Establishing a Free or Low-Cost Community-Based Program. There are 282 such programs in 43 states already. Anyone who wants to start a community program can secure a free electronic version of this book by emailing Mark and mentioning they saw this mentioned in Parachute. There is also a free 67-page workbook that you can print out from your computer. It is called the Step Ahead Workbook and was produced with funding from the Minnesota Department of Corrections. Currently, it is sponsored by Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. https://careerwise.minnestate.edu/ex-offenders/workbook.html. But the most detailed help I know of is from a man named Dick Geither. He is head of Job Search Training Systems in Indiana and has worked a lot with ex-offenders over many years. Send Dick an email at workwizard@aol.com asking for his ex-offender training packet, and he will send you a 255-page ebook that you can download and even print out. the first 102 pages of which are exclusively for ex-offenders. This is an incredibly helpful resource, and it's free. A great public service from a tremendous human being. 6. Former patients of psychiatric hospitals. According to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, 18.5% of U.S. adults experience mental illness in a given year. That doesn't necessarily mean that they were hospitalized, but it does mean they had serious problems, and probably overcame them. The same general comments that I made earlier apply here. The only questions an employer need ask are, what skills are needed to do this job, and does this person have them? And does this person get along well with other people? With employers, this is a prejudice, not a handicap. As a job hunter, just keep going until you find an employer who is not prejudiced. 7. Others. There is hardly a group you can name that does not face prejudice from some employers. That's because employers are human beings, glorious in their individuality and lamentable in their humanness, including their prejudices. Employers vary greatly. There are employers good and kind, and employers who aren't. Personally, I draw comfort from all the employers I run into who are a credit to the human race. Here is a letter I got from a successful job hunter recently. As we went along in the interview, some of the things the employer told me were, I'm very flexible with schedules. I want to put people in activities that I know they'll be the best in, but that means that some weeks you're scheduled for 3 evening shifts. If that's ever a problem, I really want you to tell me because I can fix it. I'm also a firm believer that you need to be at your absolute best before you can pour into people here. That means if you get really stressed out, I want you to tell me. Just yesterday, one of our employees came to me and said, I'm so overwhelmed right now. So I sat down with her and we moved some stuff around. Now, that also means that we are extremely team-oriented. If someone cannot take a shift because something is going on at home, everyone needs to be willing to take that up sometimes. But you always know that everyone here is willing to do the same for you. Also, when we're stressed, we seem to resort to silliness. I knew immediately that this was the place for me. The last handicap, shyness. During the whole job hunt, what's going to torpedo you most? What handicap is king? Well, shyness is near the top of the list. Call it anything else if you want to. Low self-esteem, fear, anxiety, nervousness, sweating. But shyness it is, and shyness it remains. Often we, the unemployed, who may be absolute experts at connecting and communicating with faceless people on the Internet, through computer games, apps, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, and other social media, suddenly turn to jelly when we have to go face-to-face with people. Shy. A lot of us would never think to use that word to describe ourselves, but surveys have found that as many as 75% of us have been painfully shy at some point in our lives. Many of us still are. This always comes as a great surprise to my European friends because they picture Americans as assertive, aggressive, and similar words. And sure, some of us are, but that's not who most of us are, especially when we're out of work and have to go sit across the desk from employers face to face. I myself have been painfully shy much of my life, but no one ever guesses. So what to do if we are shy and feel utterly unequipped to deal with all the social interaction we're going to have to do during our job hunt? There is an answer and a method that works. First, a bit of history. John Crystal often ran into this problem, so John suggested that the way anyone cures themselves of shyness is through enthusiasm. If you're talking with someone, for example, and you are enthusiastic about the topic under discussion, you will forget that you are shy in your excitement. Everything depends on what you're talking about and how you feel about that topic. So, he said, if you're shy, only go after a job you feel really enthusiastic about. Seek information only about a curiosity that you feel enthusiastic about the prospect of learning the answer to. And so on and so forth. John followed this up by inventing a practical 3-stage plan of action to cure job hunters of shyness. Those who have followed John's advice in this regard have had a success rate of 86% in overcoming their shyness and fears and finding a job. Daniel Porro subsequently took John's system and organized it. He observed that John was really recommending 3 types of interviews, as I noted in Chapter 8. Interviews for employment, but preceded, necessarily, by interviewing just for information, which, among other things, is a warm-up for employment interviews. And this was preceded by practice interviewing, which, among other things, is a warm-up for information interviews. Each type of interview prepares for the next, and there you have it, a 3-stage plan for overcoming shyness. Daniel, who has been Europe's premier job hunting expert for decades, organized this into an attractive and well-thought-out chart and gave it its now famous name, the PI method, which has helped thousands of job hunters and career changers all around the world with their shyness and with their job hunt. Daniel has summarized his system in a book published here in the U.S. in 1996. It is called The PI Method for Career Success, A Unique Way to Find Your Ideal Job, published by JIST Works, Incorporated. It is now basically out of print, but can be found used on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, or alibris.com for as little as $5.65 plus shipping. Daniel has a wonderful website at www.porot.com/en. Why is it called PIE? P-I-E? P is for the warm-up phase. John Crystal named this warm-up phase the practice field survey. Daniel Porro calls it P for pleasure. I is for informational interviewing. And E is for the employment interview with the person who has the power to hire you. The pie chart, which can be found in the PDF files included with this audiobook, delineates the differences between the 3 types for kind of interview, purpose, how you go to the interview, who you talk to, how long a time you ask for, and what you ask them. How do you use this P for practice to get comfortable about going out and talking to people one-on-one? This is achieved by choosing a topic, any topic, however silly or trivial, that is a pleasure for you to talk about with your friends or family. To avoid anxiety, it should not be connected to any present or future careers that you are considering. Rather, the kinds of topics that work best for this exercise are a hobby you love, such as skiing, bridge playing, exercise, computers, etc. Any leisure time enthusiasm of yours, such as a movie you just saw, that you liked a lot. A long-time curiosity, such as how do they predict the weather, or what policemen do. An aspect of the town or city you live in, such as a new shopping mall that just opened. An issue you feel strongly about, such as the homeless, AIDS sufferers, ecology, peace, health, returning veterans, etc. There is only one condition about choosing a topic. It should be something you love to talk about with other people, a subject you know nothing about but you feel a great deal of enthusiasm for is far preferable to something you know an awful lot about but it puts you to sleep. Having identified your enthusiasm, You then need to go talk to someone who is as enthusiastic about this thing as you are. For best results with your later job hunt, this should be someone you don't already know. Ask around among your friends and family, who do you know that loves to talk about this? It's relatively easy to find the kind of person you're looking for. You love to talk about skiing? Try a ski clothes store or a skiing instructor. You love to talk about writing? Try a professor on a nearby college campus who teaches English. You love to talk about physical exercise? Try a trainer or someone who does physical therapy. Once you have identified someone you think shares your enthusiasm, you then go talk with them. When you are face to face with your fellow enthusiast, the first thing you must do is relieve their understandable anxiety. Everyone has had someone visit them who has stayed too long, who has worn out their welcome. If your fellow enthusiast is worried about you staying too long, they'll be so preoccupied with this fear that they won't hear a word you are saying. So when you first meet them, ask for 10 minutes of their time only, period, stop, exclamation point, and watch your time like a hawk using your watch or smartphone timer, as I explained in Chapter 8. Okay, you're there. What to talk about? Well, a topic may have its own unique set of questions. For example, I love movies and TV, so if I met someone who shared this interest, my first question would be, what movies or shows have you seen lately? Or, what do you think of Game of Thrones? Or, who's your favorite actress? And so on. If it's a topic you love and often talk about, you'll know what kinds of questions you begin with. But if no questions come to mind, your fallback position is the following ones, which have proved to be good conversation starters for thousands of job hunters and career changers before you, no matter what their topic or interest. Addressed to the person you're doing the practice interviewing with. How did you get involved with or become interested in this? This is the hobby, curiosity, aspect, issue, or enthusiasm that you are so interested in. What do you like the most about it? What do you like the least about it? Who else would you suggest I go talk to who shares this interest? Can I use your name? May I tell them it was you who recommended that I talk with them? Then, choosing one person from the list of several names they may have given you, you say, "Well, I think I will begin by going to talk to this person. Would you be willing to call ahead for me so they will know who I am when I go over there?" Incidentally, it's perfectly okay for you to take someone with you during this practice interviewing, preferably someone who is more outgoing than you feel you are. And on the first few interviews, let them take the lead in the conversation while you watch to see how they do it. Once it is your turn to conduct these practice interviews, it will usually be easy for you to figure out what to talk about. Alone or with someone, keep at this practice interviewing until you feel very much at ease in talking with people and asking them questions about things you are curious about. In all of this, as you are trying to conquer shyness, fun is the key. If you're having fun, you're doing it right. That depends, of course, on how enthusiastic you are about what you're exploring. If you're not having fun, you need to keep at it until you are. It may take seeing 4 people. It may take 10 or 20. You'll know. Once you're comfortable with practice interviewing, you'll be ready to move on to the next step, informational interviewing, which I discussed in Chapter 6. In conclusion, self-esteem versus egotism. As most of us know, the proper attitude toward ourselves is called good self-esteem. But self-esteem is an art of balance, a balance between thinking too little of ourselves and thinking too much of ourselves. The name for thinking too much of ourselves is egotism. We have all run into that at some point in our lives, so we know what it looks like. Some of us have even caught a passing glimpse of it in the mirror. In our culture, and others, we are taught to recoil from this in horror. We even have mythologies warning us against it. The story of Narcissus comes to mind. Poor guy. See https://en.wikipedia.org/wiki/narcissus_mythology_. If you are unfamiliar with the myth. In order to avoid egotism, a lot of us go way overboard in the other direction. We shrink from ever declaring that we have any virtue, any excellency, any special gifts, lest we be accused of boasting. And so we fall into that opposite pit from egotism, namely ingratitude. We appear ungrateful for the gifts that life, the universe, God, you name it, has already given us. So how do we adopt the proper attitude toward our gifts, speaking of them honestly, humbly, gratefully, without sounding egotistical? Just this. The more you see your own gifts clearly, the more you must pay attention to the gifts that others have. The more sensitive you become to how unusual you are, the more you must become sensitive to how unusual those around you are. The more you pay attention to yourself, the more you must pay attention to others. The more you ponder the mystery of you, the more you must ponder the mystery of all those you encounter, every loved one, every friend, every acquaintance, every stranger. People from other cultures will tell you about the tall poppy theory of life, with its implication that you shouldn't stand taller than others in your field. That has a lot of truth to it, but you make yourself equal to others not by lowering yourself, but by raising them. Pay attention to others. What are the favorite skills of your best friend or mate? Do you know? Are you sure? Have you asked them what they think they are? Have you complimented them on these skills during the past week? Start now. Just remember, it's no sin to praise yourself as long as that heightens your awareness of what there is to praise in others. What is success? To laugh often and much. To win the respect of intelligent people and the affection of children. To earn the appreciation of honest critics and endure the betrayal of false friends. To appreciate beauty, to find the best in others, to leave the world a bit better, whether by a healthy child, a garden patch, or a redeemed social condition. To know even one life has breathed easier because you have lived. This is to have succeeded. Bessie Anderson Stanley, 1879 to 1952. Traditionally attributed to Ralph Waldo Emerson, 1803 to 1882. Chapter 11, The 5 Ways to Choose or Change Careers. The first way to choose or change careers, the Internet. The first idea that occurs to people seeking guidance on how to choose or change careers these days is the Internet. Naturally, there is lots of advice there. But more specifically, there is O-Net Online, which I mentioned in Chapter 5. It is a digital online treasure house of information, and up-to-date information at that, about careers. Go to the site and you will see www.onetonline.org/find or www.onetonline.org/search. Suggested careers, or occupations, are grouped or classified by any or all of the following. Industries in great demand. Green economies. Largest number of openings anticipated. STEM disciplines. That would be science, technology, engineering, and math. Amount of preparation or training required. ONET-SOC codes. Military Occupation Classification, Equivalencies, Abilities Required, Occupational Knowledge Required, interests, skill sets, work values, and work activities required. Values you want at work. Tasks and duties involved. Tools, technology, machines, equipment, and software used. And so on. Once you find an occupation you want to know more about, they have a specially developed content model. www.onetcenter.org/content.html, which can run 10 to 12 pages of printouts for each occupation. Maintained by the U.S. government's Department of Labor, it is very thorough, but at the same time, hate to say it, limited. Chief among its limitations is the fact that while its predecessor, the Dictionary of Occupational Titles, 4th edition, covered 12,741 occupations, ONET covers only 900 or so. Their claim is that the DOT, as it's called, was for a manufacturing age, while ONET is for an information age. Anyway, this decision to just cover 900 or so leaves a lot of careers, occupations, and jobs uncovered and unmentioned. Limited funds are cited by ONET as a large part of the reason for this decision. Still, you may find a lot of very helpful stuff there. The second way to choose or change careers, tests. They're technically not tests. Their real name is instruments or assessments, but we'll use the popular name for them here. I'm not sure how well they'll help you choose a new career, but you will find them everywhere. In books, on the internet, in the offices of guidance counselors or vocational psychologists, career coaches, etc. And sometimes this turns out to be exactly the kind of guidance, the kind of insight, the kind of direction that career choosers or changers are looking for. But why only sometimes? Why doesn't this search for a magic bullet always work? Good question. Since I've watched these tests literally for decades, I can share with you my 6 learnings about testing. 1. You are absolutely unique. There is no person in the world like you. It follows from this that no test can measure you. It can only describe the family to which you belong. Tests tend to divide the population into what we might call groups, tribes, or families, made up of all those people who answered the test the same way. After you've taken any test, don't ever say to yourself, "This must be who I am." No, this must be who your family am. I grew up in the Bowles family, surprise, and they were all very left-brained. I was a maverick in that family. I was right-brained. Fortunately, my father was an immensely loving man who found this endearing. When I told him the convoluted way by which I went about figuring out something, he would respond with a hearty, affectionate laugh and a big hug as he said, "Dick, I will never understand you." Tests are about families, not individuals. The results of any test are descriptors, not of you, but of your family. That is, all those who answered the test the same way you did. The SAI family, or the Blue family, or the INTJ family, or whatever. The results are an accurate description of that family of people in general. But are they descriptors also of you? Depends on whether or not you are a maverick in that family, the same way I was in mine. These family characteristics may or may not be true in every respect to you. You may be exactly like that group, or you may be different in important ways. 2. Don't try to figure out ahead of time how you want the test to come out. Stay loose and open to new ideas. It's easy to develop an emotional investment that the test should come out a certain way. I remember a job hunting workshop where I asked everyone to list the factors they liked about any place where they had ever lived, and then prioritize those factors to get the name of a new place to live. We had this immensely lovable woman from Texas in the workshop, and when we all got back together after a break, I asked her how she was doing.